28th, 26th. 26th.
The date?
Mm-hmm.
I guess.
Yeah, okay. Test. This is Dave Crippen of the SOB4 Design History Center at the Edison Institute in Dearborn, Michigan. And today, which is October 26, 1987, we're talking with Mr. Robert
H. Daler,
D-O-E-H-L-E-R. Mr. Daler is has had a long career in design over a span of about, 30?
I'd say about 35 years.
35 years. And we'll ask him to give us his career reminiscence at his own pace.
On second thought, I better make the money. That's all right. You can argue.
Just start beginning.
Well, I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in December of 1922. And at the age of 8 months, I moved with my parents and brothers to Iron Mountain, Michigan, where my father was to take charge of power at the plant Ford was building up there, a plant that was built for the purpose of making wooden, primarily wooden parts for the Model T body frame, which was made of hardwood. And perhaps because my father was an engineer, and although I think it's in my genes, I was always been interested in automobiles.
He had initially been with a railway.
That's right, Milwaukee Electric Railway, Wisconsin Electric now,
right,
it's called.
Okay.
It's the Milwaukee utility.
Milwaukee Electric Railway and Light.
Yeah.
And now it's Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Electric. Well, it isn't even that. It's they've created a holding company, and I don't even remember the name of it now. You know, all those names,
right,
corporations have been going. But anyway, the stress of the big city, and I remember Dad saying if they lost power at the rush hour and the trolleys were stopped in their tracks, there was hell to pay. And it was just at that time that pulverized coal was coming into use, and he could tell some pretty hair-raising stories about problems in the power plants. At any rate, he got a nervous breakdown and wanted to get away from it all, and that's why when he heard about Ford building this plant up in the, I guess he'd kind of admired Ford anyway from a distance, and yeah, and
he was a power engineer, right?
Yes, as was also Henry Ford in his
exactly
original career.
Mm-hmm.
Our talk around the dinner table frequently centered around cars, and I absorbed it all. And by the time I would say I was 10 years old, I knew what I wanted to be, and that was an auto designer.
Really? You lived in Iron Mountain?
Yes.
How long?
Well, till 18.
Till 18.
Till I graduated from high school. And of course, I was an ardent Ford booster. And, the Ford products of the 30s gave me, I felt, a lot of incentive to be a Ford booster.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were exciting. Although the auto industry in general was very exciting in the 30s. It was a period of just amazing development. The difference between a 30 Model A, or even if you will, a 30K Model Lincoln, and a 1940 Lincoln Zephyr, they were just totally, they were worlds apart. Not only the way they looked, but the way they rode on a trip.
The Iron Mountain plant had undergone something of transformation with the introduction of the Model A Ford, had it not? In terms of what they did there?
Well, my recollection, remember I was 8 years old when 1930 came along, and My only recollection is they made wooden parts. They may have made more truck parts beginning in the early 30s.
Well, with the introduction of the Model A station wagon, they seem to have taken a new
I suppose, yeah, I suppose that's...
As the lessening of parts for, as the decade wore on and the more the
That's right. The automobile, it was out of automobile body material.
And the use of the wood body station.
Right. So trucks and station wagons were really the only remaining thing left for wood.
And really, probably the only company, the big three, that were making their own station wagon bodies.
I guess so.
Yeah.
But the Ford station wagon bodies of that period, 39, 40, 41, and the early post-war years. If you saw them next to a competitive station wagon, there was no comparison. And I'm not saying this out of prejudice, as you'll find in this interview. I think I'm quite objective.
What way?
The workmanship, the quality of material. They use this finest quality birch and maple. The joints were
fine, I think, too.
Well, maybe for the slats in the roof or something like that.
Yeah.
I doubt if they used pine. They might.
Or the exterior, yeah.
I really didn't even believe in station wagons myself.
Did you?
I once made the remark to Mr. Nelson that didn't endear me to him at all, that they would look much better if they took them out of the crate. But,
this is Walter Nelson, who is the chief general manager of the Iron
Mountain. Yeah, but I did have to admire the workmanship that went into it, and I think much of this was due to his efforts. They were beautiful. They were a thing of beauty, just for the workmanship.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I graduated from high school in 1941.
Is that Iron Mountain?
Well, actually, we moved to Kingsford in 1930.
Okay.
Kingsford is an adjoining company town, you might say. It was named after Edward G. Kingsford, who I understand was some distant cousin of Henry Ford's.
That's correct.
And
whose name lives today in the Union Carbide.
Yes, the briquettes.
Briquettes.
Yeah. But he was, Kingsford owned a lot of timberland up there in the Upper Peninsula, and as I heard it, he persuaded Henry Ford to put his plant there.
Mm-hmm.
Also, around 1920, Ford and his company of famous camping partners, Edison, Firestone, and Burroughs, camped up there on Cowboy Lake, which is very near Iron Mountain and Kingsford, and where Ford later built a hydro plant, which...
On Cowboy Lake?
Well, it was on the Menominee River, which separated Wisconsin and Michigan, but Cowboy Lake is right off the river there.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't know all of that early history as much as I would like to, but it's very fascinating. And this hydro plant was also under my father. It was in the power department.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right, wouldn't he, yes.
And all of these things, I always used to be impressed, terribly impressed, maybe terribly isn't the word, extremely, by... Well, I might as well say right out the outset, Henry Ford, Sr., the first, was one of my personal heroes. When I read some of the later things about Ford's, or I read later in life about some of Ford's ruthlessness in dealing with some people, I had to work a little bit to maintain this hero worship. And at other times, I didn't have to work at all. I was in agreement with him on many things. One of the things I admired about Ford was the way he kept his plants, his factories. And if anything, the Iron Mountain plant was, I think, even more so in the area of outstanding housekeeping than perhaps the Rouge. One thing, they didn't have such dirty operations as foundries and steel mills and such. I know the powerhouse was just absolutely, well, I've been in hospitals that were much messier than the Iron Mountain powerhouse.
That certainly colored your outlook.
Yes.
As a teenager.
Yeah. I remember such things also, just an amusing thing, some amusing things that I think it was 1938. Henry Ford would come up there maybe on average about every other year, I would guess.
Yes.
Maybe more frequent in the earlier years.
Come up with On the Arbo.
Yes. And in that book, Dad tells where he came up in his private car, railroad car.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
One time they chartered a Ann Arbor car ferry.
Really?
And this was all before my time, really, before I was old enough at least. But I do remember when he came up in 38, the reason I remember it was 38 is because I was in the driveway washing Dad's car, which was a 38 Ford Deluxe with the Widow's Peak. I'm looking at a station wagon version of it right there on the wall now. And he called home and told Mother he wanted a clean white shirt delivered at the factory gate immediately. And this was because Henry Ford was expected, and I guess he was afraid the shirt he was wearing might have had a bit of stain around the collar.
Mm-hmm.
But such was the excitement when Henry Ford was expected. And Dad would tell how when he came to a plant, usually the first thing he'd seek out would be the powerhouse.
His old standing room.
Yeah, and he said he bounded up the stairs there two and three steps at a time. Mm-hmm. This when he was in his, well, I guess he might have been in his late 60s or 70s then.
Mm-hmm. He was 75 in 1938.
75 and 38. Mm-hmm. So I was raised very much in the legend and the mystique of the Ford, the old Ford Motor Company. So I was quite excited when in 1941 I was given a letter to present to the personnel office at on Miller Road there that would put me in the company. Here at last I'd be working right in the heart of it all. Well, they couldn't put me, or they didn't at least put me right in the styling department. I was put in the Ford training school.
Trade school or apprentice school?
The specific name of this was the Ford training school. It was part of the, it was an apprentice program, so.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Where was it located?
On, just inside the gate four there on Miller Road. And in this school, you were put on the various metalworking tools, the basic tools, mm-hmm. shaper and lathe and milling machine and grinder, just to see what feel you had for this. And there was related schoolwork. I think this was a 3-month program, and those who passed. Well, let's say those who were in the top part of the class went to the tool room to go on a tool making apprenticeship. And others went in the, I guess, on the, they found room for them, or they tried to find room for them on the line in the factory. And, well, this was quite a shock to me. I had led kind of a sheltered, maybe even precocious life up to then, and
had you taken any technical curriculum at high school?
Well, mechanical drawing and,
yeah.
and geometry and
sure.
algebra, which I absolutely hated.
So did I.
It's so abstract, you know. It
doesn't do anything for you.
But I did beautifully in mechanical drawing. Uh-huh. I got my instructor was very what does the word be? Effusive? Is that it?
Mm-hmm, sure.
In his praise and
about your ability.
In mechanical drawing. And it was largely a repeat of that, I modestly say, in the mechanical drawing classes that I took at the Ford Trade School, which were in connection with this apprenticeship course. I had an instructor named Slade there, a man whom I greatly respected, and whom I felt he respected me, or he, we got along fine. And I look back with fondness on those years, and also by association to Henry I, because he was the one that set up these things, and he wanted to be sure that succeeding generations had a good background of training mm-hmm. in the mechanical arts. And it wasn't too long after Henry's death that these things started to be neglected. The only thing that counted is what contributed to the bottom line of profit for the company.
I think they lost their vision, lost Henry Ford's vision of preparing generations of,
that's right.
of
yeah.
students
yeah.
for practical work in the shop.
That's right. So, anyway, I went to the tool room, and again, I had only gone to Detroit. My object was not specifically to work for the Ford Motor Company. It was to get into automobile designing,
mm-hmm.
which later became to be known as styling. In the Ford organization, it was called the design department, not the styling
that's
department.
That's interesting, yes, right.
Even
as far back as Gregory's day.
Yeah, design department.
Design department, yeah.
Well, especially in Gregory's day, because he had Edsel's backing. And later on, a man named McPherson became very powerful in Ford engineering, and he wanted this design department strictly under his thumb,
mm-hmm.
so it became known as styling department,
right.
which was really a put-down,
yeah.
an intentional put-down.
Mm-hmm.
But many stylists don't really do much to deserve any more than that title, because they are little more than window dressers for automobiles. Their attitude is very superficial. I'm getting ahead of the story, however. At any rate, working in the tool room in October of, probably early October, whatever 3 months from early June was, in the fall of 41, I will never forget those, especially when I was put on the afternoon shift, working on the shaper. I think that was the first machine they put you on. And I had a very tough foreman. And all of this was just a little bit much for me to take. You know, I looked at these long rows of lights 40 feet up there in the tool room, and on they seemed to go, you know, the perspective, you saw them go off into infinity. It was just utterly overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
I'd come from this small town, you know, and
mm-hmm.
and
or individuals counted or something.
Yeah, everybody was so tough and impersonal. I was yearning to get out.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from my basic desire anyhow to get into design, I intensified my efforts. I worked on a little portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
I had no formal training in
mm-hmm.
art or anything. This was just my own self-taught talent.
But bolstered by your
well, my
ability.
Yes, I hope so. And so I made these pencil sketches, half a dozen or so, and then I went around. Right now, I was a little disillusioned, and even given the perspective of an 18-year-old, even a little bit maybe better at the Ford company. Here, their most ardent booster was being treated so cavalierly.
We've all had those feelings over the years.
And so the first place I went to try to get a job was General Motors. And I got an interview up there with a man named Andrade, who was pretty high up in the...
Jules Andrade.
Yeah. Have you
heard of him? Yeah.
And, well, he was very congenial and talked to me in an avuncular way, is that
right.
The word? And
like a Dutch uncle.
Yeah. But he had to inform me that they were in the process of disbanding their styling department.
Just what year was this?
October 41.
Uh-huh.
Pearl Harbor was 2 months later.
Right.
And then I went, I don't know how I managed to get an interview at Ford. I really don't remember. But anyway.
Over here at the engineering lab?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I did. I got in the lobby there and I was put on hold. I think I waited out there for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my old resentment was starting to seethe again. Or let's say my newfound old resentment. But not out of control. I mean, I wasn't irrational. I don't think. But I think there was a tendency in those days everywhere to sort of humble you a bit. Maybe not. I don't know. Anyway.
Did you use the expression "cool your heels"?
Well, that would have been appropriate to that situation. That's the way I tended to interpret it. Nevertheless, I was thrilled to be in the lobby of the Ford Engineering Laboratory. I had seen reproductions of this picture of the old mail carrier delivering mail in his Model T touring car. And, you know, this was a legend coming alive for me.
Was it on the wall?
In the lobby, yeah.
The Norman Rockwell.
Was that a Norman Rockwell? This was a huge...
We got the original.
Yeah. Well, that's where it was.
Mm-hmm. Favorite of Henry's.
I believe it. Well, anyway, finally, maybe they had just forgotten me. After all, you know, if I were in their shoes, things might not have been any different. Anyway, a man finally came out, and it was Johnny Walters, who had done the instrument panels for the Ford products, which I greatly admired. I thought he was absolutely a genius. The instrument panel on the 40 Zephyr, the 39 Mercury, 40 Mercury, I thought they were really superb. So Johnny looked at my stuff and seemed to be, he seemed quite impressed. So anyway, I got a job in the styling and the design department.
They asked you to come in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. However, they too were beginning to trim back.
Yeah.
But not as much as GM. I think mainly because of Henry's opposition to the war.
Exactly, yeah.
And
he wasn't going
to acknowledge there was a war going on over there. Which at the time was another thing I admired him for. At the time we weren't... Well, these things hadn't happened, and we weren't even convinced that the groundwork was happening for them. The concentration camps and all that stuff. But anyway, so here I was in the Ford Design Department. I had reached Valhalla at last.
Great.
And what a contrast with working in the tool room, you know. In the tool room, we had a rush to that lunch wagon, bolt down our food in 20 minutes. And if I can backtrack just a moment,
yeah.
Just to give the atmosphere, when the bell rang, you had to be at your machine with your apron on, and the machine had to be running.
Wow.
And
that cut off a couple minutes.
And this poor kid in the machine next to me, he had gotten an ice cream bar off of the lunch wagon. And he was at his machine all right, but he was finishing the last of his ice cream bar. So this foreman named Yates, they always wore bow ties so they wouldn't get caught in the machines. And they were leather or leatherette bow ties, black bow ties. Very stern man. He wouldn't brook any nonsense at all. And I don't hold it against him because I knew he had to be that way. That was his job on the line. And but anyway, he came up and he yanked that thing. He just pulled it right out of this kid's mouth, and this poor kid was shaking. And he gave him a brief verbal tongue lashing. And but anyway, that was sort of the atmosphere. I suppose I would have felt the same way in the Army. Fortunately, I didn't have to face that. But
it's even worse in the 20s. End of the 30s, things had moderated slightly.
Well, the Union had already come in at this time, but of course they weren't in the training school. And don't think I'm a Union sympathizer either, because they certainly went much too far the other direction. But anyway, this was why I just felt I was in heaven out there in the design department. And I was put on just to give me something to do, so they wouldn't have to think of something to do. They just gave me some clay tools and said, here, go ahead. And I was working on the rear quarter of one of these first flush-sided proposals, which eventually wound up being which were put in production. One is the 48 Mercury and the Cosmopolitan and also the little car, which eventually became the French Ford Vedette. The overall supervisor at that time was an old German fellow named Dick Beneike. And he was quite a character. Well, we made fun of him because of his accent and the way he murdered the language. He would say, for instance, close their window halfway open, and rub their clay good in mit der Hans. And he was short and kind of stoop-shouldered, and he looked sort of Neanderthal. But I liked him. I liked him from the beginning.
Basically, he was a good guy.
I think so. I feel he was. And I think, well, there wasn't anybody out there then who I didn't feel was a good guy. The atmosphere throughout was very low key.
You think that was set by the chief designer?
Pardon?
You think that tone was set by the chief designer?
Gregory?
Mm-hmm. Bob Gregory.
Well, I always admired Mr. Gregory. I liked the way he dressed, and very good taste, I thought, then and now.
Mm-hmm.
And he had an air of refinement about him. I suppose part of his appeal to Edsel Ford, too.
He'd come from Long Island. Apparently, a family had a little money.
Yeah.
And he knew something about boats.
I think. That interview the other night, he handled himself very well.
Yes, very well.
I only wish I could have understood it. I mean, no reflection on him, but
the sound reproduction
was bad. I couldn't hardly understand a word. But nevertheless, I could tell he was very articulate and
so in command of him.
Yeah.
Can you be helpful?
Well, it was at this time also that I met Fred Hoadley.
Oh.
And I didn't really get to know him very well before the war, but I do remember him, and I had met him. And as for some of the others that I recall, well, there was, I don't know if my comments about Gregory went on tape before, but...
It did, but if you wanted to amplify it.
Well, here was Gregory. I knew from what I had read and heard before I ever left Iron Mountain that Gregory was the creator of the Lincoln Zephyrs. That is the... At least he took Jarda's work on the 37 model Zephyr there and made it into a producible front engine automobile, and I think he did a beautiful job of it. And
initially, apparently, the front end of the 36. After that, he took over the whole thing.
Yeah, but that body remained throughout the through the 39
exactly.
Model year. And then they did that masterful facelift in 38.
Yes.
That was
largely Mr. Gregory.
In its time frame, I think the 38 Zephyr was probably the most exciting car of all time for me. Perhaps most enthusiasts would say the Cord, but the Cord was kind of off in a... It was not a high-volume car. It was almost a custom-built car. It might have been compared more with a Lincoln Continental. But the Zephyr was a mass-produced car, and it really had more relevance to the scene, much more relevance to the scene than the Cord did. And all the Zephyrs through 41 to me were exciting. And here I'd read about Gregory being the head stylist, well, we didn't use the word stylist, and the head designer for Ford. And it wasn't only the Lincoln Zephyr, the 39 Mercury, I thought was a beautiful car. Ford was a style leader in those days, a leader, and I think they were a leader because they went their own way. They didn't appear to be so concerned about what General Motors was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And
actually, General Motors, in terms of the Zephyr, as you probably well know, were very much the concern of General Motors. I mean, Ford's efforts in the late 30s with the Zephyr and the later Zephyrs, the early Zephyr, the later Zephyrs, and the Continental were really a matter of grave concern to GM.
Yeah. Well, the Zephyr, the 38 Zephyr strongly influenced, well, all 39 cars had their version of catwalk cooling,
exactly.
Which was, some of them were done in extremely poor taste. I mean, the Zephyr was so exquisitely done.
Mm-hmm.
But the worst ones, I think, were the Chrysler products. They were terrible. But so, in my estimation, Gregory had a running head start. In my book, that he was the creator of those cars. I looked up to him as well as disciples of Frank Lloyd Wright look up to him today. You know, a legend.
Uh-huh. How did he work for in person?
Pardon?
How was Gregory to work for in person?
Well, remember, I was just a young 18-year-old kid, and
you're slugging clay at the moment.
Yeah, I don't think I ever exchanged any words with him during that 3 months period I was there.
Mm-hmm.
During that stint.
Remember John Nager?
Yes, I do. I remember John Nager very well, and he was a nice. I have nothing but good memories mm-hmm. about him.
Very helpful.
I don't remember Johnny so well from that pre-war period. I remember him more clearly from when I came back after the war.
Yeah.
But
Ed
there,
Martin? Was that
I remember seeing Ed Martin around there, and he was sort of up in the inner circle. And
I think he was a confidant of Gregory's.
I had that impression.
Assistant.
Yeah. And it was never quite clear to me what his job was there.
I think a lot of people wondered.
Well, he was busy. I don't mean that, but it wasn't clear to me what he did. And there was Walter Krook. He was involved with interiors, I think, or fabrics, or
I think so.
colors or whatnot. He was a very dapper, suave gentleman, and that's about the only comments I could make about him. I didn't have much, any contact with him.
You remember Frank Francis?
Oh, yes, very well. Frank Francis was the personnel man. And
was he?
Well, I don't know if that's the right title for him, but he was Gregory's gopher, if that's the right
on
term.
Personnel matters.
Yeah. It was Frank that went around checking fellows if you needed to know something about personnel and scheduling. And Frank was a very good man for the job. He was tactful and polished and thoroughly likable. He was, let's say, the opposite of abrasive, perhaps. The word abrasive would be the opposite of everything that Frank was. I shouldn't use that word, so I should stick to the positive words.
What about Benny Barbera?
I remember Benny primarily from post-war days, you know, because this was totally strange to me when I came there. And of course, I was worried about my own performance. And I do remember Martin Rogitko clearly, though.
Ah, yes. He was the layout man, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was, I would say the most influential men there perhaps were obviously Gregory at the top and Dick Benike is the head clay modeler, and Martin Rogitko as the is the man who took these clay models, translated them to paper, so that the body engineers over at the airframe building got it right. And Martin had a lot to do in the original layout of the package drawing, to see that the seating was right and the placement of pedals in relationship to doors and windows and so forth. Ergonomics, they call it now.
Right, yeah. Now,
my impression of Martin at that time was that he was rather aloof, which I didn't, you know, I didn't take offense at this. I expected important people to be aloof. And because he was part of this organization, I also looked up to him as a part of the legend.
Did we talk about Ed Martin?
Martin Rogitko.
No, did we talk? Oh.
Yes, we did. Yes.
Did we talk about Ed Martin?
Yeah.
Ed Martin became sort of a miniature historian of the Continental. John Najar asked him to put down his reminiscences on paper on how the Continental first came to be.
I see.
And that was printed in a couple of publications.
Well, he was in a position to do it. Sure.
He did the first model.
Yeah. And Ross Cousins, of course, was a great idea man, aided,
a marvelous illustrator.
Aided by his expertise as an illustrator.
Right.
I mean, he was very good at these kind of loose pastel renderings.
I guess giving a dimension to a department that didn't quite have that, in the way he could translate, apparently he could translate fairly basic drawings into something which became advertising art.
Yeah. Well, he was very good in his field, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
I think everybody there, they had top-notch men. Yeah. They didn't have to...
Gregory apparently did not brook any incompetence or well, at least if you were training, but tried to get people...
Yeah, I would say so.
One more quick question: did you ever run across some of the engineering people like Joe Galam? Would he have impinged on your
interview? No, I.
B.Y. Talberg.
After the war,
Talberg.
Yeah, I always wanted to see Joe Galam because I'd heard about him when I was in Iron Mountain. Yet.
Had you? Legendary figure.
Was he? Well, when we're off the tape, I'd like to ask you more about Galam.
Well, he had been Henry Ford's chief engineer for many years, and by virtue of his longevity, he had Mr. Ford's ear.
Yeah.
and I believe shortly after the war he retired.
Well, was he, did he get deeply involved in the aesthetics, or was he primarily a body engineer?
He was primarily a body engineer, but as you know, from that period, the body engineers felt that they were, you mentioned Mr. McPherson.
Yeah.
The body engineers felt they were the designers. These people were simply decorators. And he would insist, to sometimes Mr. Gregory's annoyance, he would insist on being, having the final say on certain shapes.
Uh-huh.
So something of a dictator, aided by his longevity and presumed clout.
Well, take the 32 Ford, the first V8. Did Gregory have any input in that?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think that was done at Briggs or Murray. And
the shape of the, let's say, the radiator and the front the fenders and the body lines.
I think there was a collaboration between Briggs and the body engineers.
Yeah.
And that was when Robertson Chardo that.
Yeah.
A lot of that.
Well, even that wasn't a superb job. Yeah. Although I thought the 33 and 34 were, in the context of the times, they were the most beautiful Fords ever, to
I
me.
I agree with you. I think Mr. Gregory's first real influence came with the 35 Ford.
I don't know, but my impression has always been that a fellow named Phil Wright did the 35 Ford.
With Briggs?
With Briggs.
You may well be right.
Yeah.
Maybe the 36, the first input.
And Gregory did a fine facelift of that with the convex fenders on the 36 Ford.
Exactly. As you can imagine.
Taking a front end, which supposedly Cotto originated.
As you can imagine, Edsel depended on Briggs. Cotto, Charda, Roberts, very skilled body design operation.
Yeah.
And so, but as Gregory came along, first doing some personal cars with Edsel Ford, and then gradually getting his confidence, then Edsel Ford decided to shift the design operation into an in-house group. Headed by Mr. Gregory, but it was a very transitory, transition was slow. And even as you know, the design for the 36 Zephyr was pretty much charted, except for the front end.
From the cowl back, yeah.
So probably the 36 was the first time Gregory's design influence began to be found.
Yeah. I think if you research the 35, you'll find it's a Phil Wright design.
Phil Wright, I'm sure you're right, yes.
But then, well, I won't get too far afield here.
Go ahead, what were you
going
to say?
Well, I'm trying to confine myself to comments on what I am reasonably certain that I know what I'm talking about. And this is something I don't know, and that's who really did the styling on the 33 and the 33 Ford, the one I admire so much.
The 33?
Yeah. Now, what I've heard, I have some reason to believe. Actually, what I'm asking for is Mr. Gregory's history, and that's a whole other story. But Gregory is supposed to have done an English job, the Y job, they call it. And this car sort of had the basic theme of the 33 Ford in it, mm-hmm. 33 American Ford.
Right.
But the 33 American Ford was larger, and it had more room to develop this theme, and it was much more graceful. But to my knowledge, there was no Ford styling department in 32 when this was designed. So, did Gregory design it, or did Briggs design it, or was it a collaboration, or what? If whoever designed it, my hat's off to them. I can look at a 33 Ford, any body model, and still get excited today. As my friend Ted Peach used to say, a thing of beauty is a joy for...
Is a joy?
Well, the saying is it's a joy forever, and
he
with his sense of humor, says it's a joy for...
Oh, a joy for, that's cute. Yeah.
What what we're trying to say is that if it's truly beautiful, it may be out of fashion, but that doesn't mean it isn't beautiful. I can wax ecstatic about, and I have, about, over here in the museum, you've got Theodore Roosevelt's panel brougham, horse-drawn carriage,
right,
from about his days in the White House, about 1910. And that thing is a symphony of lines. I mean, it is just beautifully proportioned and shaped.
I'm sure the early automotive body designers learned a lot from Ernie Coach.
Yeah. This, with all due respect to Harley Earl, Harley Earl didn't invent styling or aesthetic designing.
No.
I mean, this has been around since the caveman.
Exactly.
And it was very highly developed in ancient Greece. But we're getting afield, too far afield. So that covers the, well, some things I wanted to mention when I worked at Ford Design Department before the war. Besides being in the design department, I remember lunch hour particularly, because then we took a long walk down the hallway. Styling was on the south end of the building, and we walked the full length of the engineering laboratory and then through another hallway to the cafeteria. And the heavenly smells of these soybean muffins were coming through the hall. Henry Ford and his soybeans, you know. And he had a German cook, I understand, in the cafeteria. And to eat that food, it was like going home again. I mean, it was clean and wholesome food.
Uh-huh.
It was all just too good to be true.
Uh-huh.
And it was too good to be true, because Pearl Harbor came along, and my little dream was over for a while anyway.
Uh-huh.
And of course, it was a different ball game after the war. But my only contacts with, my only recollections of Henry and Edsel during this period, one noon, another young man and myself, Gene Requa was his name. Pardon? R-E-Q-U-A. I don't know what happened to him. He went to California, and that's the last I heard of him.
He was in the design department?
Yes, at that time. Also a sort of an apprentice. Anyway, there was quite a lineup at the cafeteria there, and he told me if we could get there 5 minutes earlier, we could largely avoid that line. So we sneaked out about 10 to 12 to go to the cafeteria, and I'm feeling a little uneasy about it. And you'd never do that at the Rouge, man, or anything like that. Oh, it smokes.
Thank you,
And so here we're walking down the main aisle, and way down at the other end of the aisle, we see this gaunt figure coming toward us. Oh my God, right away I knew who it was.
So, like, did he have a straw hat on?
No, he didn't have a hat on.
Oh, he didn't have a hat.
He was just strolling around,
mm-hmm,
and headed for his office, apparently. We didn't know at that time where that was. So we cut over to the side aisle.
Uh-huh.
And darned if he didn't also. So we ran smack into him.
Uh-huh.
And he had a big grin on his face. And he just said, "Hi, boys."
Uh-huh.
Of course, we stuttered a response. So this was Henry Ford. And it was the only time in my life I ever exchanged words with him, although my dad had talked with him.
But he had some grin on his face because he knew what you were doing.
Fortunate. Well, we thought he did.
Yeah, right.
And maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
He didn't ask you how you liked your job, did he?
No.
That was one of his favorite.
Really? I wish he would. I'd love to have talked with him. But it was, brief as it was it's a happy remembrance. And my meeting Edsel was very much the same. I was a little bit late quitting one night, and most everybody had left, and I was walking down the hall. And here was Edsel walking in the other direction. And I looked at him, and I was afraid to say hello, you know. I was brought up in this old German ethic, you know, where everything was quite formal. You didn't speak, children didn't speak unless they were spoken to. And you had respect for your elders, and so forth. And, but he said, he gave me a friendly hello, and I answered him. Then we also saw him. Edsel was in the styling department frequently, but of course I didn't have occasion to talk to him.
You mean the design department?
Design department, yes. And one time I recall Henry coming through there with a raincoat on, and all alone. He wasn't followed by any
retinue.
And I think it was that same day that he and Edsel sat down on a bench in there and had a long talk. Which somewhat gives the lie to these stories that Henry couldn't be bothered with that. So, you know, that.
Well, quite the contrary, they confirmed it endlessly.
Yeah.
But they often disagree.
Well, I'm sure of that. But
90% of the time, they were same thing.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
At least according to what I've heard.
I had the impression that Edsel was largely ignored by Henry.
On the important things, yeah. Perhaps, but on questions of design, he deferred to Edsel.
Well, I didn't know that Henry was even interested in design at all.
Well, he would say, I think I've heard people say, that he would say, well, that's Edsel's department. But he was endlessly fascinated, but he would occasionally drop in to see what was going on in the design department and with Edsel, and occasionally on his own. But it was not...
Yeah. That sounds more plausible than what I've been led to believe.
But there is a historical precedent for thinking that on some main issues, mainly social and industrial issues, he disagrees.
Yeah. Well, I'm well aware of those.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so as I say, the dream was about to end, and it ended on Pearl Harbor Day, and I knew that what came to pass was about to happen, and I had the choice of going back to the tool room from whence I'd come, or going out in the drafting department at Willow Run. Well, I would have liked to have gone to the drafting department, but I conferred with my father, and he advised me to go to the tool room if I didn't want to get my head blown off when they had even no further need for me as a draftsman. Well, I went to the tool room, and that's where I spent the war years.
Don't gloss over them. Tell us a little bit about your experiences there.
Well, this was a tool-making apprenticeship,
mm-hmm.
And it was an extension of the apprentice school work in what was called the training school, which was part of the apprentice school, which was all under, I think, the Henry Ford Trade School, wasn't it?
Right.
We're in the B building there. That's where we went for our classroom-related studies. And this was merely an extension of that. And I did very well, if I say so, in the tool room. I like working with my hands, too.
Doing more work, pleasure?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Making tooling for various things that Ford made during the war. One little incident might bear repeating here. Kind of increases my. In hindsight, it's a matter of nostalgia for the old Ford Motor Company. I was working on the day shift at this particular time. You know, I went through all shifts, but. Was working on the days at this time. And I got in there at 7 o'clock or whenever it was, and I was running what they called a Bullard, huge machine, a vertical lathe.
B-U-L-L-A-R-D.
Yeah, with a revolving horizontal table. And we were on almost a, what you might call a semi-production job. We were turning big, huge barrels that were used for casting the aircraft cylinders. And the midnight shift man had left the machine all set up with taking a heavy cut on the inside and a heavy cut on the outside. And when you're taking these heavy cuts, the workpiece gets very hot and it expands. And so, well, I started up the machine as I was supposed to, but while it was running, I was also supposed to keep my eye on it. And since these are long cuts that take 15 minutes for the tool to reach the full cut, I went to, I don't know, it was to return or borrow a tool from a neighboring worker on the same machine. And he pointed back at my machine. I looked back and here this barrel had come loose from the jaws and it was starting to rock. Well, I panicked. I ran back to my machine and tried to turn it off with this big foot lever, and I kicked at it frantically, but I just didn't push it hard enough. Meanwhile, the thing is continuing to rotate, and finally it comes out of the jaws and gets jammed between the side head, and, well, to make it short, it did about $10,000 to $12,000 worth of damage on the machine, which translated in today's money would be yeah, well, much more than that, maybe at least 50,000, I'd say. Well, I thought my goose was cooked, but my record was good up to that point. So my boss looked at it, and well, I could see he wasn't happy, but he didn't come unglued, as they say now. But we had to go see the boss of the entire tool room. And, or at least this was, there was a man named Durling, I think, and also a man named Snyder. This was Snyder when we went to see. His office was up in the middle of the building.
You're back in B building now?
No, in the tool room.
Oh, the tool room, where was that?
Across the street, directly south of the aircraft, where they made the aircraft engines, mm-hmm. across the street to the south. Well, what's the main street going through the Rouge there, the main east-west? You enter at gate 4 and you go on this main street right over to Schaefer Road. Mm-hmm. It's the main east-west artery through the Rouge. And the aircraft engine plant faced it from the north, and the tool room faced it from the south. And the north half of the building was devoted to die making, and the south half to tool making. I was in the tool making half. Anyway, Snyder came and he listened to the story, and we walked back and looked at the machine. And do you have any handcuffs here? Mr. Snyder didn't say much, and I was expecting him to give me a real tongue lashing. Something like that, I don't suppose, made him look too good either. Well, he finally said, be more careful in the future. That's all he said. Mm-hmm. And I think he actually felt sorry for me. I wasn't making a big scene or anything. I was just anxiously awaiting developments, the verdict. So Snyder was known as a very glum. If you remember the cartoon Out Our Way, Bull of the Woods.
Oh, yes.
Well, I think Snyder was the prototype for that.
Was he?
Will of the Woods in there, and always glum, you know, never, you never saw him smiling, and you thought he was a real crab. Well, I loved the man after that. Well, in all, my experience in the tool room was good, and I'm grateful to Ford for having given me that experience.
Invaluable, I suspect.
Well,
anyway.
It really wasn't invaluable. It wasn't appreciated by stylists.
I mean, appreciated by you.
Yes, by me, it was.
Background that you
And the schoolwork that went with it was rigorous.